Hello, and welcome to the Open Systems Media eCast, Key Emerging Agile Systems Engineering Techniques for Internet of Things. I'm Kurt Schwader, your moderator, with today's speaker, Bruce Powell Douglas from IBM. Today's schedule consists of about 55 minutes of presentation, leaving about 5 to 10 minutes at the end of the hour for audience Q&A. Before we begin, let's run down some important features of your viewing console. First is the Enlarge Slides button. This button will maximize the slides to fill your entire screen. The Download Slides button allows you to download and print the slides if you'd like a hard copy to follow along with. The button labeled Forward to a Friend enables you to send an email to someone that will include a registration link to this eCast so they can also attend. The Ask a Question text box enables you to participate in today's event. You can simply type your question into the box and submit it using the Submit button. You can submit questions at any time during the presentation. We encourage you to do so early and often while you're looking at the material and the question is fresh in your mind. We'll address as many of these as we can during the closing Q&A, and if you have a question pertaining to the eCast operation itself, you can submit those too, and one of our technicians will be happy to respond to you during the eCast. We are excited to have Bruce Powell Douglas with us today, embedded software methodologist, Ironman triathlete, systems engineer, ultramarathon cyclist, contributor to UML and SysML specifications, writer, black belt, neuroscientist, classical guitarist. Bruce Powell Douglas, who has a doctorate in neurocybernetics from the USD Medical School, has over 35 years of experience in developing safety-critical real-time applications in a variety of hard real-time environments. He's the author of over 6,000 book pages from a number of technical books, including Agile Systems Engineering, Real-Time UML, Real-Time UML Workshop for Embedded Systems, Real-Time Design Patterns, Doing Hard Time, Real-Time Agility and Design Patterns for Embedded Systems in C. He is the chief evangelist at IBM Internet of Things, where he is a thought leader in the systems space. He can also be followed on Twitter at IronmanBruce. Welcome, Bruce, and the floor is yours.
Thank you, and welcome everyone to this webcast. Today what I want to talk about is Internet of Things and systems engineering and how it and all these various concerns play together for the construction, development, operation of these systems. Okay, so the first thing I want to mention is Internet of Things, this IoT. It really is kind of everywhere. Of course, as an athlete, referred to kind of as the an age grouper these days. I have all kinds of biometric data that's acquired in wireless devices, such as heart rate, such as power output, and then you have things like speed, cadence rate, all these kinds of things. And these are uploadable. You can analyze them, look for trending, for the effectiveness of training. That's one place where you see Internet of Things as entertainment, fitness, smartwatches, locations, and tracking. And automation, home automation, building automation, you have things like access control, lighting, temperature regulation, predictive maintenance, energy optimization, and so on. In smart cities, you've got e-meters, water flow management, you've got infrastructure management, power delivery, you've got surveillance, you've got all kinds of issues and concerns addressed there. Smart manufacturing, you've got the operation of manufacturing per se, you've got predictive maintenance of the equipment, real-time inventory, asset tracking, safety maintenance, and so on. Healthcare, and as I mentioned, my doctor's in neurocybernetics from USC Medical School, so I've designed lots of medical systems. Some remote monitoring, things like Holter monitoring, cardiac monitoring, ambulance monitoring, and telemetry to hospital emergency rooms, drug tracking, access control, predictive maintenance of systems, and automotive. You've got things like infotainment, telemetry. You've got car-to-car and car-to-infrastructure communications for traffic optimization, for collision avoidance, and all kinds of things. So even today, as we're kind of emerging into this IoT space, IoT is already everywhere. So if you think about the infrastructure for this kind of a system of systems enterprise architecture, we start kind of the bottom level with things like sensors, actuators, devices. So you've got things like temperature sensors, pressure transducers. You've got accelerometers for the sensor side, for the actuation side. You've got motors. You've got hydraulic systems. You've got engine control. You've got all kinds of systems down at kind of the bottom, either sensing what's going on or performing activities in the real physical world. And above that, you've got gateways, smart edge nodes, using communication protocols to upload this information so it can be managed in the cloud in terms of data management, trend analysis, real-time processing, analytics. And on top of that kind of data, you've got portals, dashboards, long-term optimization systems. And so any kind of IoT application is really not just an application system in the cloud, an application system on your desktop, or some things you hold in your hand. It's the combined systems of all of those elements working together. So MessageSite is one kind of infrastructure system runs in the cloud for doing this management of systems over time that acquires data or controls systems over massively distributed sets of nodes in the real world with cloud-based analytics, real-time analytics, data playback, subscriptions, and all kinds of applications. So it's just one place where IBM plays in that space. IBM has all kinds of tools in the water, if you will, things that we do. So from cloud management, IoT clouds, connectivity, data refining, to asset management, to predictive analytics, and tools to develop and deliver those systems. And that's kind of where we're going to focus today, because we're talking about system engineering in the IoT space. So along with this IoT and engineering space concept, the question comes in, how do you take a traditional product development lifecycle and use it in a connected world? How do you do that? So we developed this concept called continuous engineering. So it's not about just the standard V cycle, you see a picture of it here on the slide, where you get some requirements, you do some system engineering, you develop the software, electronics, mechanical aspects, you manufacture it, and you deliver to the customer, done, right? It's really about getting feedback from customer both during development and post-development, doing these analytics for getting defect reports, managing the systems, getting operational data for operations and optimization of those systems. We call all of that continuous engineering. And the three primary pillars of continuous engineering are really managing engineering knowledge of the systems, continuous verification of engineering data, not just of delivered systems, but also of incompletely specified systems. As we do this agile method of doing part of the system's requirements or the system's architecture, we want to have some measure of quality of those work products as we develop those systems. We do this through a process of continuous verification, which is something we'll talk about, and continuous validation that those systems will actually meet the customer need once they're delivered and as they're delivered. And then strategic reuse. As we build systems in the IoT space, we don't want to just reuse the source code. That's not what we mean by strategic reuse. Certainly, reusing source code is good. It's a wonderful thing. However, there are many work product we produce, many kinds of engineering data that we develop, such as safety analysis, reliability analysis, security threat models, functional requirements, quality of service requirements, system architectures, interfaces. There's all kinds of data. And we want to be able to reuse all of that data for strategically reusing those intellectual property assets. So looking at it in terms of another viewpoint of the overall kind of process of continuous engineering, we've got things like portfolio management and product line engineering. And these primary activities are where we primarily focus on identification of the assets we need to produce and reuse of elements of those assets. We also see the monitoring of the operational deployed systems. That's where the I meets the T. That's where we do this operational maintenance and control, command and control is called, of these deployed systems. And then in the middle, then, we've got the engineering of those systems, the manufacturing of those systems, and the deployment of systems operationally. And over on the right-hand side is where we really kind of manage this engineering knowledge and engineering capability. So today we're really going to focus on the operations side and the development side. So we look at monitoring deployment, and this is where the things meet the internet, right? The team meets the eye. The activity really is about monitoring control of deployed systems in the real world. And you want to provide feedback to the R&D environment. This is very important for things like train infrastructure, you know, the status and correct operation of switches and monitors. For medical systems, you want to be able to get the defects from those systems and do timely updates. We also want to provide data for business analytics, for usage monitoring analytics for things like billing, enterprise-wide and system-wide optimizations. We want to look at predictive trends so you can decide where you need to focus your services and your resources. Predictive maintenance of deployed systems is a huge thing. In standard maintenance, you have a maintenance schedule, right? And regardless of whether the systems are operating correctly or whether they're worn, we maintain them on a regular basis. Predictive maintenance optimizes that by basing maintenance on runtime conditions. Do you have evidence of leaks in your hydraulic systems? Do you have evidence of a trending increase in heat production? Do you have operational evidence of a reduction in delivered force over planned delivered force, right? So using that, we can predict what kinds of maintenance are required and when they're required and optimize those systems developments, widely used in things like aircraft systems and engine control to actively predict when to perform maintenance, because we get megabytes of data per second from these aircraft engines. And we can use that to predict when maintenance is appropriate. So it's also a life-critical and feature-critical system. Distributed environmental processing, infrastructure management, things like defect detection, energy management, manufacturing control, patient management, facilities automation. So monitoring deployment adds incredible capabilities that just a few years ago were not available. We had to do this using manual processes, and usually heavyweight processes requiring paper production of change requests and orders that are carried off in manufacturing. We can really optimize that process with the IoT. The other part, and we're going to spend most of our time really talking about this, is the systems engineering part. The development of systems in an agile way so that they can be operationally deployed and communicate and collaborate across the internet to achieve all of these benefits. So let's look at what we mean by the system engineering parts of this. Now, we standard nomenclature represent the system engineering process in this kind of V cycle. So even if you're doing an agile, iterative, incremental approach, it still makes sense to view it this way so we can talk about the various activities, even if instead of taking 2 years to do this V-cycle, you might do it 20 times, each time taking 2 weeks, okay? So we do things like get our external stakeholder requirements, do requirements analysis, define a systems architecture, hand off to what we call downstream engineering, software, mechanical, electronics, optical, chemical, nuclear engineering, and so on. Develop those aspects, integrate them, component test, integration test, verification test against the requirements, and validation and acceptance test against customer needs. So even if you do this incrementally, it still makes sense to view it this way so we can discuss it. Now, look at kind of tooling for this. In the IBM world, we've got tools for managing requirements and requirements traceability, things like DOORS and DOORS Next Generation. For model-based systems engineering, or MBSE, we've got RAFSE for systems. For the software development part, we've got model-based development using Rhapsody for embedded software development. These tools are mature and have been out for a long time. For model-based testing, we've got tools like Test Conductor, which implements the UML profile for test, test real-time for doing the testing parts. We've got traceability management, because remember, we've got a lot of different groups working on different aspects of the system, creating different system engineering data, and they all have to be consistent. And you have to be able to demonstrate that consistency. We do this with traceability and data integration. And so you can do some of that with DOORS. You can do some of that with the MVC tools like Rhapsody. But Realm is a tool that's really optimized for a variety of different kinds of tools, like PLM tools and manufacturing tools and engineering tools and requirements tools together to find all of the impacts of requirements changes or defects in our systems. And then we've got collaboration, because in today's internet-connected world, we don't have just simple co-located teams. We've got teams that are distributed across, across geographies, across time zones, and we have to somehow integrate all of their engineering work. So we've got design managers to help integrate that design work. And then we've also got test management. So we want to not only provide the test cases, but also manage the tests when they're done, how complete are they, what are our defects, how do we issue change requests based on tests to go into updated requirements or updated designs. So all of that test management, we have tools called, for example, Quality Manager does that. And then for project planning, tracking, what we call project execution management, change management, we've got tools like Team Concert, right? So all of these things are integrated together to form the tooling for the IoT. So it's not just one spot tool that solves part of the problem, it's solving the entire problem that really allows us to really address the needs and the ultimate goal of IoT, which is integrate everything to solve our needs, right? So let's talk about the system engineering part per se. We're going to focus on that. It's a big topic. This could be a year-long course in your university. We're going to talk about one aspect, just the system engineering part. And how do we do that in an agile, kind of model-based, iterative, incremental, effective way in this IoT world, right? So if we look at the agile model-based system engineering process, this is the Harmony process. I'm the author of this process content. We see, if we kind of squint a little bit, it looks kind of like a V. So this is really the stuff that occurs on the upper left-hand side of that V cycle we saw before, the production of the system engineering assets. So system engineering is certainly broader scale than that. There's also stuff on the right-hand side of the V for component test, integration test, validation, and system acceptance test. That's also really part of system engineering. We're going to focus here on the left-hand side of the V, specification, architecture, interface definition, dependability analyses, things like safety requirements, safety, reliability, and security, right? So that's what this iteration here is, stuff on the left-hand side of the V. This can be done once, as it is in a kind of standard V lifecycle, or it can be done many times. If it's done many times, it is then iterative. We do part of the system, typically organized around use cases, develop the architecture, support that, maybe hand that off to downstream engineering where we work on the next set of requirements. We incrementally construct our work data. So our requirements are constructed incrementally around usage or around stories, some subdivision of the overall functionality of the system. We do this by continuously verifying the quality of our engineering data. One of the laws of Douglas is about 240 of these. One of the laws of Douglas is the best way not to have defects in your system is not to put defects in your system, right? So how you do that is with continuous verification. As you create your requirements, you analyze them. We'll talk about exactly how that works to demonstrate the quality of those requirements before you hand it off to somebody else to implement, and then find those defects downstream and have to feedback, say, oh, no, that the requirement is inconsistent, the requirement is incomplete, the requirement isn't properly specified, and then really close that loop so we hand it off higher quality requirements. We still have those other loops, but we want to continuously verify our data as we create it, and we call that test-driven development, right? Continuous validation means that we want to continuously show, demonstrate through execution, through simulation, through formal mathematical analysis that we're meeting the customer's need. The last thing you want to do is produce the wrong system. System that doesn't meet the customer's need, and this is a real problem. We address that by continuously validating our systems and our engineering data as we create it. The only way to have this continuous execution, this continuous verification, continuous validation, is through model-based approaches. You cannot effectively do this if all you do is you write lots and lots of text. Now, text is wonderfully expressive, but it's ambiguous and it's imprecise, and different people mean different things with the same words. And so model-based is really a means by which we can create verifiable engineering data so we can demonstrate correctness, completeness, accuracy, and fidelity. If only someone had written a book on this topic. Oh, wait, someone has. So this book, Agile System Engineering, talks about these concepts in some detail. And when I wrote this book, I used an example. So I thought, what would be a good example? I decided, if you've ever seen the movie Aliens with Sigourney Weaver, that robot suit called a Waldo would make a great subject for a design. So it actually goes through the system engineering process with that as a subject matter. So we called it the T-Rex system. And there's a specification of stakeholder requirements and system requirements as well as system designs in the course of this book. And we'll talk about some of the work product it generated as we walk through the system engineering process in an agile way to do that. To start with, we identify what are the use cases or the capabilities of the system. Use case can be thought of as either a collection of flows into and out of the system for common usage. These flows can be control flows, energy flows, data flows, material flows, gas flows, hydraulic flows, whatever. Or you can think about it as a set of coherent requirements around the usage that define those flows. I think those two viewpoints are really equivalent, but they're slightly different in how you represent them. And so here we've got some of the uses of the system. For example, we've got move a limb. So as the pilot who sits inside the suit exerts pressure on the inside of the limbs, that uses transducers to interpret that pressure as requests for movement. And then we move the limbs based on that and other kinds of feedback, as we'll see. In terms of kind of the IoT side, we've also got use cases around managing the fleet. For example, where is it? What is it doing? What are the various statuses of those? Doing billing management. For example, you might have a set of systems out there and they're billed by the hour. So you've got to accumulate hourly use from a variety of these deployed exoskeletons to do billing, right? And then you also, as we mentioned before, have predictive maintenance. You want to predict based on things like hydraulic pressures, temperature trends, force trends, when is it appropriate to do maintenance, and what kind of maintenance is it appropriate to do. So these capture those sets of requirements. Using the use case diagram, we can show the allocation of the requirements to the use case. In this form, this is the form I like to use. So I use, for different use cases, diagrammatic forms. And then for the summary, I use tables. So I use tables generated from these diagrams to look at summary of allocation requirements to the different use cases. So this is one for billing for usage. We also have one for performing predictive maintenance. We see the links here. And we also have one here for move the limb. We see there's a lot of requirements around exactly how the limbs get moved. Both functional requirements, quality of service requirements, and dependability, safety, reliability, security kinds of requirements. So we're not going to, I don't expect you to read that, right? But there are a lot of requirements around that. So once we understand the allocation of the requirements, then we want to really understand, is that a complete set? Are they correct? Are they complete? Are they consistent with each other? Are they accurate? And do they have the right fidelity, right? So we do that, we analyze those requirements. And that's what this activity in the process is about, system requirements, definition, and analysis. So, of course, we focus, there's a lot of activities we do here. We're going to focus here on generation of the kind of textual requirements, system shall do this and move limbs at this speed with this much force, and so on. And then we analyze the requirements, see are they complete, are they correct, are they consistent, are they accurate, right? And there are three different ways to do this based on either a flow model, such as with activity diagrams, a scenario model based on sequence diagrams first, or on perhaps a state model. In all cases, you end up in the same place with the same work products, but it depends upon the nature of the work and your personal preferences, which you might use. So looking at the flow-based analysis, we start with defining the system context. So we define a block that represents the use case or the system playing the role of the use case, and the blocks representing the actors, the elements in the environment with which this system interacts, so we can understand, so what interfaces need to be supported, what flows come in, what flows come out, so we can really kind of understand that. Then we start doing our flow models and activity diagrams to understand, so what's the sequence of actions and activities, what comes in, what goes out, to understand the flow of control, flow of execution of these. From that, we can derive then scenarios, which are singular points that we have branch points and parallel regions in our activity diagrams. These are like one path through that. Based on that, the scenarios, we look at, so what goes in, what goes out. So identify the connection points, the ports, and the things that flow. These can be, again, control flows, data flows, command flows, energy flows, material flows, right? The flows that go in and out. From this, we then build a normative state machine that describes that set of behaviors, and then we update the functional requirements based on this simulation of this model. Once that's all done, then we typically add traceability links to the other work products, you know, the test cases, the stakeholder needs, the architecture, the interface definitions, and so on. And then we might perform a review, say, yes, this all looks good. Let our subject matters look at it and say, yeah, okay, that you've thought about all the things. So this is incremental system engineering. For example, this increment here is called a nanocycle. It takes place usually about an hour at a time, 20 minutes to an hour. So we'll do some portion of this use case, understand that, build us a simulation model of that much, verify that we got those small number of requirements, those 10, you know, 5 to 10 requirements, right? And then we'll add the next set of requirements, incrementally constructing this engineering data. This is where we do this kind of test-driven system engineering. So we incrementally construct this possibly complex model of this use case, verifying the data as we create it before we hand it off to some implementer to find the defects and things we didn't think of. So as we construct this model, we start off with identification of what we call the execution context. So here we see that we've got a one block here representing the use case. So it's a system, just we're focused on one use case at a time. And then we have different blocks representing the actors, the elements in the environment with which we're interacting. And we've got currently empty definitions of the interfaces that capture the flows in and out of the system, as well as their various kinds of qualities of service. And then we might build up an analytic model. In this case, it's a flow model based on activity diagram of this. So we see on the left-hand side that the pilot actor is exerting pressure on his limbs and arms and legs, which inverts via pressure transducers into the system, which then computes how much force and movement you're requesting, performs that movement, and we move the arms possibly with, you know, heavy limbs. The system handles 1,500 kilogram loads. So that reduces that, excuse me, that produces resistance, which is also fed back into this closed loop control system, so that we can produce appropriate amounts of generated force, right? So that describes, if you will, the flow as we move the limb in the system. From that, we can derive scenarios. So this is a scenario of maintenance use. So one of the things we have a set of requirements around how a maintenance user uses a laptop to plug into a data port on the system to command movement, to install and verify, configure systems, perform tests, and so on. And this is one of those scenarios, one path through that system. And we can drill down. We see both continuous and in this case, just continuous flows, but also discrete episodic or event flows in the systems, so we can understand how the system coordinates in different circumstances to perform different kinds of purposes within the context of this use case. And everything here is representing one or more requirements. We're not doing a design at this point of the internal part of the system. We're trying to understand the requirement, because what is a requirement if not a specification of control and data transformation the system must perform? Not about how it will do it, but what is needed. So we're using a formal language to specify those transformations. Those are the functional requirements. Quality of service requirements are specifications of how well those transformations are performed, how accurate, how quickly, what kind of resources are required. Those are quality of service requirements. What kind of reliability with which those are performed. As a result of this kind of analysis, now we find we've filled in some of the details of those logical interfaces, what flows into the system in terms of pressures, what flows out of the system in terms of movements, in terms of force, in terms of resistance. Also, we see discrete flows as well in terms of enable the system, disable the system, command it to move, and so on. So we see all these flows in and out of the system. These are our logical interfaces for the system. This can then be captured in a normative state machine. Again, the states, the events, the guards, the actions, everything here except otherwise notated are here to represent one or more requirements. There are a couple things here you see comments on. They're non-normative. These are just to facilitate the debugging or execution of the state machine. That's it, right? So all the other things are there representing specific requirements. So this is a statement of the requirements using a formal language to allow us to really analyze the correctness and accuracy of those requirements. On the left-hand side of this view, we see views for enable us to control that execution or control the simulation. So the upper left-hand side, this is automatically generated by Rhapsody as we identify events or flows of interest, and Rhapsody will generate us a web page to allow us to then control that simulation, to insert events, to monitor the data, or to change the data. Or I could go to what's called a panel diagram in Rhapsody and create controls to control or monitor the data, right, to control the simulation. On the right-hand side of the screen, we see the execution outcomes. So the bottom right-hand side, we see the state machine that we just saw before in its current state as the system is dynamically simulating behavior. And so we've captured in the color coding using the current state. On the upper right-hand side, we see a sequence diagram which is drawn dynamically as the system exchanges messages with the actors, as the simulation proceeds. So we can look at this and say, is this really what I expect to happen in this case? Remember that the reason why we do this is to identify missing requirements, requirements that are in conflict or inadequate, and to specify logical system interfaces. And I've consulted to, well, literally hundreds of projects using these kinds of techniques, and it's been enormously helpful in reducing requirements defects that would otherwise be caught late in the project and require significant rework, throwing away engineering data because it's now wrong because our requirements were wrong, and redoing it. So this is really an enormous benefit in agile system engineering and agile development for the IoT. Okay, so next let's skip ahead to architecture because we only have so much time. In architecture workflow, we see we identify the subsystems, these large-scale elements in our system. In an IoT system, the large-scale subsystems are really systems. They're like, for example, as we'll see, the exoskeletons themselves, the cloud applications, and the desktop applications communicate with the cloud. All of those would be subsystems. And then within those large-scale systems, there are subsystems that collaborate and communicate and coordinate. So we want to identify those and sort of allocating our system requirements to those pieces. Some of that allocation is just a matter of taking a requirement and plopping it down, allocating it to one of those systems or subsystems. But usually most of it is taking a system-level requirement and decomposing it and deriving subsystem-level requirements and then allocating those. At the subsystem level, then we take those, we construct use cases at the subsystem level, unless they're trivially obvious, which is, in my experience, rarely the case. We also will then update the subsystem specifications. We'll update the data schemas, control models, and continue to assess safety, reliability, and security for dependability concerns. So we look at our enterprise architecture for this IoT system. We see certainly that the big piece we notice is the T-Rex exoskeletons themselves, and there are potentially thousands of these, perhaps hundreds allocated to one location or another. These collaborate with systems that are now either cloud or desktop-based, such as fleet management, such as usage tracking, for example, for billing, such as usage tracking for predictive maintenance, right? So these are our large-scale systems in the system of systems architecture. And then we can drill down into the exoskeleton itself, the T-Rex itself, and say it consists of a number of subsystems. There are four limbs that we concern ourselves with, left leg, left arm, right arm. There's a helmet assembly with a heads-up display. There's a torso assembly with which contains a variety of subsystems such as power management, coordination subsystem, proximity detection, so you don't, like, step on people. They hate that when you do that to them. GPS management, communication, because that thing has a built-in cell phone communication system, actually video cell phone communication system. And if you look a little deeper, then the limbs themselves we see are composed of joints and segments, proximal, medial, and distal. So like shoulder, elbow, and hand joint, right, or grappler joint. And these are also, so this also is part of the subsystem architecture, right? And every one of those exists to meet some set of requirements. Every one of those has interfaces to other subsystems, so it can communicate, collaborate, and coordinate its behavior. As part of our system engineering work is to define all of those things. So as we get from our system level requirements, we have to then allocate, possibly derive, or derive and decompose and allocate requirements. And that's what this shows here. For the limb management, we see this limb management. We take the requirements and we decompose it, and then we allocate these decomposed derived requirements to the various subsystems. Lastly, we'll talk a bit about the handoff. This is probably the most common question I get. So once you've done this kind of model-based system engineering work, how do you hand it off to the software group? How do you hand it off to the electronic engineers? How do you hand it off to the mechanical designers? So how do you do that? So we have a well-defined approach and process for doing that. So on there are kind of two flows. On the right, left-hand side, let's go left-hand side first, we produce a shared model that has the common elements. So these would be interfaces between subsystems or systems, in this case, in the enterprise architecture. The data path includes the data, the flows, material flows, the accuracy, fidelity, and so on. And we produce now the physical interface specifications, because the teams are going to go off and actually build physical subsystems. They need to understand, how do I physically connect? What are the communication protocols? What is the bit map of those messages? So I can exchange messages with those subsystems. That's all stored in what we call the shared model. And on the right-hand side, every subsystem typically has its own subsystem model. And one of the first things we do is we import our specification of that subsystem model from the system engineering model. And then we determine, what is the deployment architecture? So what parts are going to be met by mechanical engineering, software engineering, electronic engineering, and so on, and allocate requirements to those parts, and define the interdisciplinary interfaces. How does the software talk to electronics? How does the electronics motor interface with a gearing system that's produced by the mechanical engineers, right? So those kind of interfaces must be defined. And that forms the basis of this handoff. So here's an example of one of my favorite diagrams for this, what I call a subsystem interface diagram. It's just a block diagram that shows the subsystem and all of the interfaces around it. So these are formed using interface blocks, using proxy ports from SysML 1.3 in this case. And it defines the flows in, flows out of the system, what the interfaces are required for this. So at a glance, I can see what the system needs from other subsystems and what it provides to other subsystems. This is for the GPS navigation system, the GPS and inertial nav, so we can track where the system is. Now we're doing the deployment architecture, which means we're now going to allocate, identify pieces of our architecture which are corresponding to different engineering disciplines. So we see there's software aspects, electronic aspects, mechanical aspects, and these are defined by interfaces between them. And that's what we need to specify so the electronic engineers can build their bit, software engineers can build their bit, and they're likely to talk to each other when we're done. This is, again, a kind of a well-known breaking point in many systems engineering projects, is that they didn't really specify the interfaces sufficiently well so that things plug together in a seamless way. Right? So we derive the physical interfaces. In this case, what we're showing is how do the software for this coordination subsystem talk to electronics? And in this case, we're talking about specifically the CAN bus. So this uses a thing, protocol called DeviceNet, which is uses the CAN bus, Control Area Network bus, as the data link, right? And so we specify, for example, CAN bus buffer for incoming messages, one for outgoing messages. We see that it's based on its CAN buffer type, and that bitmap of that area of memory is clearly called out. We also see that we receive commands via software interrupts from the electronics. When a message arrives, you get an interrupt, so we know to go look at the incoming CAN bus buffer. Once we've populated the outgoing buffer, we then write to an area of memory to tell the electronics, go send this out. So in this way, we specify the physical interfaces for the deployment architecture, in this case between the software and the electronics. This is another example. This is the avionics example showing the bus architecture for 1553 bus. Now, our logical interface specification might say, get a radar image from the radar system. And so we have an event, so get radar image, event coming back, so here's a radar image, and we've got this logical data type called radar image. It specifies things like I need to know the range, the distance, the combat ID, and so on. When I build a physical system, I'm not going to send an event. It's distributed, and it's on another device out there on the aircraft, so I need to form a bus message, in this case for an avionics 5053 bus. So this defines the structure of that bus. We've got the command words, the multiple data words, and we've got the status word. These are all defined in terms of their bit structure. You see the stereotype defined bit bit word. You see the starting bit and the number of bytes bits involved in that. And you see the commands that we support in terms of various values that go into the command byte structure. So this way we define the physical interface between the radar and perhaps the tracking system or the targeting system on your aircraft. Okay, so that I realize is kind of the fire hose introduction to system engineering in the IoT. There's more information out there. Certainly, you can search on the web. If you go to the front page, there's a thought leaders page at IBM, where there's a lot of links to presentations and white papers, and I've written an occasional book on the topic. So with that, I would like to open up the floor for any questions you might have.
Great. Thank you so much, Bruce. We are now to the Q&A. Continue to ask those questions. We've got some good questions coming in. Let's start with this one. What kinds of support systems are required to support and execute at this level of modeling, simulation, and continuous analysis? This person thinks it sounds like you'd need a Watson or a Big Blue to handle all this. Is it that intensive?
Well, yeah. If you want to do it on the cheap, you go buy a Raspberry Pi and use Bluemix and your phone to make a very kind of inexpensive, low capability, perhaps, system. So you don't need a lot to get started. If you want to build something that monitors all the traffic in New York City and can optimize traffic flow by changing the light delay times, optimizing it for maximum throughput, for emergency vehicles, and so on, that's going to require a bit more investment, right?
Mm-hmm.
From the
right.
design end, I think you want to really invest in model-based specification, model-based system engineering, and model-based development, because that just provides so much value in terms of turnaround. For the deployment side of things, you've got to invest in providing, you can use off-the-shelf middleware, communication protocols, communicate to the cloud, so then you need some sort of cloud services, and there are IBM provides them, other people provide them. So that you can do data storage, data trending, so that then you can write your applications to do trending analysis, predictive maintenance, and whatever kind of application you need. So the short answer is I think for a low-capability system, you want to basically control your own home entertainment system and microwave oven and toaster, pretty small investment, right?
Mm-hmm.
You
want
to control the Eastern Seaboard power grid, bigger investment, right?
Right.
So it scales, but scalability is one of the concerns you have to have. You have to address the tools for the level of scale that you have in your application system.
Okay. All right. The modeling and things that you kind of described on the scale of, you know, the robotics machine, does that kind of capability, does the modeling need a PC class? Does it need a rack of servers and VMs? How easy is it to model kind of your standard IoT application for medical, for instance?
Well, a PC is completely adequate for that.
Okay.
I just was working on an aircraft carrier design last month. And that particular application is an air defense system on that. The PCs were used to do all of the modeling.
Okay. That's interesting. So I was a little curious about the context of all the modeling, interface, functional requirements, and then mapping that to activities within the Agile process of creating the epics and user stories. Do you model, then create your user stories? Or are you creating your epics and user stories and then model, or you do them in parallel?
I think that the key answer is that they're parallel activities. So you might come up with the user stories or the use cases first. So these are the things, uh-huh, user stories. I'm going to start with that. And now I want to understand this user story. What does that mean,
right,
exactly? Right?
Right.
And so then I begin modeling to understand that, to clarify my thinking, to make sure I haven't missed any aspects that are important, right, take care of safety, reliability, and security concerns, right? So I do that modeling as I do that. And so throughout the system development, I do this modeling to make sure I'm meeting all the needs. And, of course, even though there's benefits in small systems, Raspberry Pi controlling your toaster kind of applications, I would do that with a model because that's kind of what I do.
Right.
I'm a model-based thinker, right? But there's benefits to do that. But benefits get exponentially larger as the system complexity increases.
Okay,
so at some point, you get to the point where you can't really do it effectively any other way. Certainly need modeling there. But even on small systems, I know people doing, you know, cardiac pacemakers, 2 or 3-person teams, who use modeling because they want to make sure they get it right, and they want to do it effectively and efficiently.
Right. Yeah, that makes sense. Here's another question. How does this change when you're defining a systems architecture for a modular, generalized platform? For example, a generalized commercial robot as opposed to kind of a functional system like you're talking about. Are there any changes?
Well, okay, so if you want to generalize that a little bit more, if you will, even more general than that is the notion of building a framework, right? So suppose you're building a robot kit, and you want the user to be able to assemble it in kind of any way they want to that meets their particular needs, right? How do we build a robot framework to meet this needs? Frameworks are anywhere from 3 to 10 times harder to make than specific applications. Because you have to meet a wide variety of needs, and you don't know what they are yet.
Right.
Right? So that's the principle that's hard. So we had a similar problem. I was working with NASA, JPL, on a spacecraft framework. And so what we did is we built this framework, and we had kind of 2 sample systems we were building to demonstrate the capability of the framework, kind of your really stupid spacecraft ready to say, okay, open this valve this much. Right, and the brilliant spacecraft, you say, go find interesting stuff and take pictures of it, right? And so do all the stuff. So by meeting the 2 ends, then you kind of meet everything in the middle. That's kind of the concept. So you have to have, if you will, demonstrator applications to make sure you've got the complete set. Otherwise, you run the serious risk of having an incomplete framework. A framework is always a partially completed system with points that are extensible either in terms of generalization or in terms of aggregation. I aggregate new parts onto it. And you have to define where those ports are and what the capability of those connection points are. And to do that, you really need to think harder about it. So making general things well, I think, is harder than making specific things.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. Not only incomplete things, but you also run the risk of terribly over-engineering it and not hitting the mark with a lot of development effort, too. So, interesting.
Right.
Here's a really interesting question. So this question is geared toward a relatively smaller IoT vendor, so who's used to building embedded systems with an engineering staff of 10 or less. So how do they jump in or get some help on these what they are calling large system design approaches while designing and constructing their IoT system? Can this be applied to small teams without encumbering them?
Oh, absolutely. I think the reason why people move to these kind of approaches is not because it's really cool, although it is really cool, but that's not why people do it. People do this because it makes them more capable, more powerful, just like the robot example I gave here.
Mm-hmm.
The reason why you want that system is because it's a force multiplier. It makes you more capable as an entity, as a node in this you know, industrial environment, right? You can pick things up that are weigh 1,500 kilograms and walk them over and put them on the shelf. You can't do
right.
that by hand, right? So it makes you more capable, more powerful. And I think these engineering tools we're talking about are the same way. You do them because they save you time, because they improve quality. If they don't do that, then why on earth would you do that, right?
Right.
So
my
experience with using on really literally hundreds, over 300 projects, is that these are force multipliers. These are engineering capability multipliers, and that's why you should consider using them.
Right, right. That makes a lot of sense. So you model once, you define interfaces, and then it's kind of set and adhered to so you don't have multiple people, you know, missing the interface or not understanding the model or what have you. Makes a lot of sense.
Right, and let me just say that modeling, too, is not just about drawing pictures. Pictures, you know, and I have a different presentation, I have a slide on this. Drawing pictures is not modeling. Modeling is defining the engineering data, which you might show in pictures. The pictures themselves are not the model. They're just the picture of the information. And so
right.
people use kind of lightweight, what I call napkin models, don't really realize this kind of benefit. You've got to do precise modeling, what I call high fidelity modeling, to really get the benefits.
Yeah. That makes sense, and that's a good point. How about any advances or gained insights in chemical kinetics that can be attributed to IoT or industrial Internet of Things?
That's a pretty specific question. I don't know. I haven't worked with a lot of people doing chemical systems
mm-hmm.
in the IoT. So I don't have any direct experience with that. I do more industrial military avionics type applications systems.
Okay.
So specifically about chemical systems, I don't have the knowledge.
Okay. You touched on monitor deployment capability at the very beginning. There's a question about, are there standard interfaces or APIs between device gateway cloud for that monitor deployment capability? It would stand to reason that if you're developing a gateway or you're developing a dashboard application or a cloud service, it would be very helpful to have monitor APIs or standards or interfaces. Do any exist, or if not, do you expect any to emerge?
Well, there's MQTT, so there's some standards that exist today.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of the things you want at the bottom end are kind of industry specific, and I think that there are emerging standards right now for IoT, and so I think they'll become more clarified and solidified as time goes on. But still, IoT is still a little bit early to create the standards. In order to create a standard, you have to have a standard practice.
Mm-hmm.
So you have to be a bunch of people doing different things and say, oh, there's some commonality here. Can we standardize this? And so that work is ongoing now, but I'd say we're not done yet. For example, if you look at systems around threat modeling, I'm involved in a group with the OMG, Object Management Group, defining a standard for threat modeling. So there's some standards like STIX and NEAM, which define standard ways of communicating operational metadata for mm-hmm. threats. And so those we're creating a standard for information exchange among those different kind of data standards. So this is an ongoing thing.
I see. Okay. Here's a question about if you have a current engineering team and you do want to move to this modeling strategy, do you have suggestions on how to get the whole team on board, ramped up, and on the same page?
Yeah, I think that's an interesting question because one thing to say, oh, isn't this great? It's another thing to actually successfully deploy it in your environment, right?
Right.
And so the best way, it's just like, the way I like it is like teaching my daughter to drive. One approach is to toss her my keys and say, good luck, and go hide until she figures out how to hit stuff, right? Another way is to do kind of a guided acquisition of skills. So she takes classroom classes, she takes classroom tests, she gets some driving experience in a controlled environment, and then basically then in an uncontrolled environment, right? So
right.
Same thing is about acquiring engineering capability. You've got to go through some sort of training, some sort of mentoring, some sort of skill acquisition. So one of the things I do for a number of companies is this thing called a engineering capability assessment, where I come in and I look at, so where strong or where are they weak at different kinds of skills. I come up with basically a capability improvement plan to acquire these skills. And some of it's about modeling, some of it's about even more basic stuff. How do I improve our engineering capability? What you don't want to do is to solve a problem you don't have. Some organizations are really good at requirements, but they're bad at architecture, bad at managing interfaces, bad at defect management. Some places they're great at defect management, but they really can't specify good requirements. So you want to understand where your perhaps engineering deficits lie, where your challenges are, and really acquire these kind of agile model-based techniques in an agile way. So use agile to adopt agile.
Okay. Interesting. A follow-up question. You mentioned some threat modeling tools, Stix, NIEMS. Do you have mnemonics for that?
Do I know the words? Nah, I couldn't tell you. You look them up on the internet. But there is actually a Rhapsody. Doesn't ship with it, but you can get it actually from me. There is a threat modeling profile. So for doing threat modeling right now, and it's part of what we're proposing as the standard part of it. So, for example, you identify things like assets that you want to protect, vulnerabilities, threat vectors, these things called attack chains, and countermeasures. And so you can reason about where you need it. So there is some stuff that's out there. But in terms of what the mnemonics mean, I'm no good with mnemonics. Sorry.
Okay. Are you talking about the Stix Cybox stuff, like the cyber observables and all that kind of stuff?
Yes.
There's an OASIS. There's an OASIS group that's specifying all that, right? It's kind of takes a page out of the virus detection, where you can standardize on cyber observables and deploy levels of security or normalcy, I guess. Okay, yeah, I think Stix is like STYX. But yeah, you can certainly look all that stuff up and also talk with IBM about those things. Here we go. If you have a number of agile software teams already in place, what would be the interface to them if you wanted to introduce an agile systems engineering process above it? I suppose these teams might be, working on various subcomponents of the overall system.
Well, that's really the handoff part that I spent just a very small amount of time talking about.
Mm-hmm.
So this handoff can be monolithic, as it is in some of ours. All system engineering is done, then you guys go run. That's not my preferred approach, but okay, it can be done that way. Or it can be done incrementally, which means that that incrementally we hand off these use cases, downstream engineering, along with architectures and logical interfaces turned into physical interfaces, for these engineering teams then to collaborate on their development in an incremental fashion. So that really the key to that is really understanding the handoff part of the process.
Right. Yep, that makes a lot of sense. So you can leverage the interfaces and the to the hilt if you have a number of engineering teams doing different kinds of things. Here's kind of a rhetorical question. Maybe we'll close with this one. Should universities be establishing an IoT degree program? Am I going to get a degree in IoT engineering, 10 years from now?
I think that's a marvelous idea because think about IoT is it brings together so many different disciplines, right? IoT, you've got to understand, software development. You've got to understand electronics, mechanical parts. But even within just the software bit, there's cloud infrastructure, there's enterprise architecture, there's embedded development, there's the desktop kinds of development. There's Hadoop. It's a huge, huge area. So bringing together the things that are really specific and important for IoT would be a great idea for military, or excuse me, for a university program.
Yeah, it would almost be a mix of, you know, you have MIS degrees that have to deal with a lot of the systems or cloud-based aspects, but more specialized, and you have computer engineering, which is a more focused discipline, and that could be software or, you know, hardware, silicon, VLSI, and try to pick and choose a mix of all that stuff and make yourself a system of systems degree. Interesting.
Right. And
well, great.
As well, yeah.
That's right. Yep. Well, this has been just a fantastic event. Unfortunately, we've run out of time. Want to thank Bruce for sharing his insight and expertise on emerging agile systems engineering techniques for IoT. We at Open Systems Media and IBM want to thank all of you, the audience, for attending today and contributing excellent questions remotely. This eCast will be posted online at the URL shown on your screen within 24 hours, and an audio-only podcast version will also be made available there. Thank you for attending, and have a great day.